Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of The Forum, where science comes to socialize. Your co-hosts today are Barbara, Cleo, and me, Aubrey. And before we get started, I want to remind you that the three of us love hearing from you on social media.
Yes, you too can socialize with science. Tweet us your thoughts regarding this and other episodes at ISGPTweets with hashtag ISGPForum.
Your comments could be referenced on a future podcast. And let's be honest, everyone loves to be internet famous.
That's very true. Anyway, this week we thought we'd switch things up a bit and discuss a different hot-button topic, one that isn't under the umbrella of food safety and security.
Yeah, this is actually a theme that has come to the forefront of many science and society conversations in recent years, and you often hear about it on the news. It's something that affects every person in their daily life.
So everyone should care.
Everyone should indeed care. The topic, of course, is antimicrobial resistance. And to put this in context for the individuals who aren't as familiar, antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, describes what happens when microorganisms evolve to overcome medications that are typically used to treat their infections.
Like MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, the antibiotic-resistant staph infection recently in the news.
Antimicrobial resistance can develop in a wide array of pests, including bacteria, viruses, parasites, and fungi.
And the reason that everyone has a horse in this race, so to speak, is that all of us either use or are exposed to antibiotics being rendered useless because of the resistance trend.
Yeah, I'm allergic to anything in the penicillin family. So if something became resistant to, say, azithromycin, I would be so screwed.
Right, so even for those of us, like myself, who tend to turn and run when we hear those long, terrifying-sounding names, it's important that we pay attention.
So in March of 2013, the ISGP convened one of its signature series conferences on the broad theme of emerging and persistent infectious diseases. The program was held at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, and the specific topic up for discussion was the all-important phenomenon of AMR.
Today we'll discuss the debate surrounding a position paper prepared by Dr. Ely Klein for this conference. Dr. Klein hails from Johns Hopkins University, and his paper involved the creation of policies to prevent inappropriate antibiotic use, as well as training the public to use antibiotics correctly.
And this is a really important topic because using antibiotics incorrectly, say prescribing them or using them when they aren't truly needed, is one of the reasons that antimicrobial resistance is becoming such a problem.
As always, if you'd like to read Dr. Klein's position paper, you can visit our website and browse the Publications tab.
Dr. Klein really set the stage for the issue at hand by explaining the reality that AMR increases medical patients' chance of dying at the hands of infection, including infections that are acquired within hospitals.
And that's really scary. It's important to note that at the time his paper was written, 2 million Americans were contracting hospital-acquired infections annually.
And of those 2 million, which were largely cases of antibiotic resistance, 99,000 were facing death at the hands of their infections.
That's almost a 5% loss of life due to AMR alone, and that statistic only considers the United States.
One of Dr. Klein's policy suggestions actually addresses this point. He thinks that the onset of resistance should be tracked in hospitals, and those facilities whose daily practices hasten AMR should incur penalties.
What kinds of penalties are we talking about here?
Well, he says that hospital reimbursement rates should be inversely tied to resistance rates, or that hospitals could be flat-out denied reimbursements in cases of hospital-acquired infections.
I could see that type of policy being pretty controversial.
Sure, but it would likely get hospital workers to improve their hand washing.
So, we can talk all we want about the United States, but during Dr. Klein's debate, there was a major acknowledgement that different solutions need to be posed for different parts of the world.
The debaters appreciated the fact that in more affluent nations, doctors function as the authority figures who prescribe and control the distribution of antibiotics.
In general, obtaining medications, and the appropriate amount of them at that, is less of an issue in more affluent regions.
While in less affluent nations, monetary issues prevent individuals from acquiring and taking the appropriate dosage. This hastens resistance.
But monetary availability isn't the only concern. The debaters mentioned how in China, physicians are financially rewarded for prescribing antibiotics.
It's not hard to imagine how that could result in inappropriate antibiotic use. It just takes one doctor to do something like, oh hey, your leg hurts? Here, take these. Headache? Try some antibiotics. And that helps no one.
And China's not unique in that sense. A debater said that in 100 out of 180 countries, regulations controlling the prescription and distribution of antibiotics are considered inadequate.
From personal travel experience, I know that these countries practically give out antibiotics like candy. Without any problem, you know, other than my obvious struggle with the language barrier, I was able to buy antibiotics over the counter when I was sick without any sort of little blue slip from a physician, which was convenient at the time, of course, but troublesome when one takes into consideration my lack of trained medical expertise.
So there's clearly a necessity to offer geographically specific solutions. But one thing that's uniform is the reality that antibiotic efficacy is much like a natural resource availability. The more you use a forest or fish now, the less you have for later use. Similarly, the more you use antibiotics, the shorter their shelf life.
When you define shelf life as the amount of time before the targeted microorganism develops resistance, then yes, that's exactly the case.
Which brings us to an important point regarding diminishing shelf lives. As we said before, in some countries, physicians are monetarily encouraged to write prescriptions. But this isn't true for all countries.
No, it's certainly not. But those countries suffer from other challenges. Dr. Klein listed numerous reasons why antibiotic use, even in developed countries, continues to happen erroneously.
These reasons included 1, patients expecting or even demanding antibiotics, 2, fear of malpractice lawsuits if antibiotics are not prescribed, 3, temporal constraints in which it's faster to write a prescription than to explain why one isn't actually needed, and 4, uncertain diagnoses.
I think we can all relate to that third one. Who hasn't gone into a doctor's office during flu season and waited 3 hours for 5 minutes of the doctor's attention? If a doctor is going to see all patients, they have to be economical with their time.
But that's not an excuse for writing prescriptions willy-nilly.
Exactly. Doctors shouldn't be the Oprah of prescriptions. You get antibiotics! You get antibiotics! Everyone gets antibiotics!
No, of course not.
Even so, Dr. Klein makes an interesting policy suggestion in an attempt to prevent unnecessary prescribing of antibiotics. He thinks that if we increase the coverage of flu vaccines so that more people get them, less people will get sick in the winter.
Okay, so the theory is that there won't be full waiting rooms, patients that demand antibiotics or uncertain diagnoses?
Well, you wouldn't eradicate the flu completely, but yeah, that's the general premise. Having less sick people will result in less antibiotic use overall, proper or improper.
So we have these antibiotics that are becoming useless, and most of them were developed years ago, even before the three of us were born. Why can't we just develop new ones?
Well, in theory we can, but it's not quite so simple.
Yeah, Dr. Klein mentions that there are major incentive barriers preventing companies from investing in antibiotic R&D.
So many barriers.
You're not kidding. One of them is that it costs more than $100 million to bring a drug to market when you include the cost of drug discovery, which is a painstaking process that resembles finding a needle in a haystack.
The debaters seem to think that more time and effort need to be spent on drug discovery. They thought that discovery hasn't become harder, but the regulatory process has become more challenging to maneuver.
True, and to make matters worse, antibiotics are significantly less profitable than blockbuster drugs. Dr. Klein cited the example of the Pfizer drugs called Lipitor and Zithromax. Lipitor, which treats high cholesterol and is therefore not an antibiotic, raked in a whopping $12 billion in 2005, while in the same year, Zithromax, a widely prescribed antibiotic, pulled in a comparatively meager $2 billion.
See, that doesn't make sense to me. You would think that because people are constantly getting sick, antibiotics would be extremely profitable. Where's the snag in that logic?
Well, while antibiotics are used by many people, the duration of their use is only about a week. On the other hand, drugs such as Lipitor require use for at least a few months, if not years.
Not to mention, people will stop taking their prescriptions or save up prescriptions so they can save a trip to the doctor's office.
I guess that makes sense. So if a company isn't making large profits, or rather, if they could be making greater profits developing long-term drugs, they'll be less willing to invest in antibiotics.
Exactly.
Ethics also come into play when we discuss the onset of AMR. There arises a question as to whether drug companies are ethically responsible for hastened resistance, since they benefit financially from selling as much of their product as possible before the patent expires.
Right. So they do all they can to distribute the product, even though improper or overuse of the product causes wider drug resistance in the future.
Wait, so are we just little cogs in the money-making machine of big drug companies?
Well, sometimes it appears so, doesn't it?
Not surprisingly, the debaters spent some time chatting about how changing patent laws could help slow AMR. Specifically, they wondered if extending the length of patent life would make it less necessary for companies to push their products' use over short durations.
And there was some disagreement regarding the efficacy of this proposed solution.
Yeah, the debaters thought this might be an unrealistic goal since, in general, people see extended patent life as putting more money in the pockets of pharmaceutical companies.
Plus, a significant portion of the debaters thought the proposed outcome was too big of an if, too big of an unknown to warrant an actual change. In other words, there's no solid reason to believe that lengthening patent lives will slow the rate of antimicrobial resistance.
Exactly. The two pieces of the puzzle are too far apart along the causal chain, but there is a little more agreement on the suggestion that certain drugs receive extensions near the end of their patent life so that both their efficacy and profitability could be preserved.
We should also mention that a rather novel idea was proposed here. Specifically, a debater suggested that patent lengths be based not on a fixed number of years like they currently are, but rather on total volume of antibiotics sold.
What would that accomplish?
Well, the idea is this: if a large amount of antibiotic could be sold and used while still maintaining efficacy, then the length of the patent could be increased. If, on the other hand, resistance began to develop, the patent life could be shorter.
There were concerns of practicality, however.
And there were questions of ethics. Are pharmaceutical companies ethically responsible for maintaining drug efficacy? The debaters weren't sure.
Well, one thing's certain. Dr. Klein suggests that companies be put under the microscope when their actions can be tied to hastened antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, he boldly recommended that patent expiration dates be plotted against drug resistance to see if there was any correlation. By this logic, companies who do seem to be causing reduced antibiotic efficacy would experience shortened patent lengths or monetary fines.
And the debaters didn't seem to have major problems with this suggestion. Except they wondered if punishment-induced short patent lengths might accidentally cause overuse when lower-cost generics hit the market sooner than expected.
The debaters also wanted to make sure that any patent laws that incentivize low antibiotic resistance included some clause or consideration for unwanted resistant outcomes in non-target microorganisms.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. You mean that we need to make sure that responsible practices discouraging resistance in one organism don't inadvertently cause resistance to develop in a different organism?
Yes, exactly.
So, what are the drug company's ethical responsibilities, if any? We'll leave that up to you, our listeners, to decide. Tweet us your thoughts.
Now, there was some disagreement regarding whether antimicrobial resistance is inevitable. On the one hand, AMR is thought to be a natural phenomenon that happens as humans and pest organisms co-evolve.
But deniers of this statement cite the fact that ciclopyrox, an antifungal agent, has been used for 30 years without recorded loss of efficacy due to AMR. Though we should mention that antibiotic users excrete resistant bacteria in their urine, even if this doesn't translate to clinically relevant resistance.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah, the debaters actually brought that up a few times.
One way or the other, our efforts should focus on stopping AMR or at least altering practices that hasten resistance.
Right. Dr. Klein asserted that we need to find ways to preserve the antibiotics we currently have while simultaneously discovering new ones for future use.
He suggests that aside from decreasing the use of today's drugs, new strategies like combination therapies and drug cycling might prolong antibiotic lifespans.
And I think that an important point we're missing here is one that Dr. Klein made in the policy issues section of his paper. He claims that in the mandatory search for novel antimicrobials, incentives that are developed to encourage R&D must also consider resistance, or else the investment is ultimately useless.
maybe not useless per se, but any new antibiotics that are discovered from the incentives will eventually become ineffective due to hastened resistance. Okay, maybe they would become useless.
So we've talked about how drug discovery needs to be prioritized, but there are valid reasons that prevent companies from investing. How do we fix that problem?
Well, Dr. Klein mentions the possible utility of public-private partnerships in facilitating R&D. He notes that this technique is what made antimalarial development successful in the past.
And an option discussed by the debaters involved the government guaranteeing the purchase of a certain amount of any new antibiotic, much like some vaccine purchase programs.
Drug discovery can also be facilitated using novel in silico programs. In layman's terms, that means that new computational processes can simulate the use of antibiotic candidates on a computer, making the elucidation of new drugs a less hands-on approach.
So the debaters weighed in on this, and their reactions were interesting. They postulated that models and computer simulations could be used not only to elucidate possible drug candidates, but also to better understand patterns of bacterial transmission and antibiotic utility.
In other words, if we can better understand how pathogens and antibiotics interact, we can better utilize the latter to treat the former.
But there were still concerns. Some said that incomplete clinical data would prevent the utility of models to deduce these relationships. Ultimately, better resistance, prescription, and transmission data are required.
And this data could come from required reporting of antibiotic use by physicians or hospitals.
True, but the debaters cautioned that requiring healthcare facilities to report potentially negative information might result in incomplete reporting. So maybe new technology development would be a better solution.
Or more time could be spent educating the public regarding the realities of AMR.
This was one suggestion that the debaters definitely seemed to support. But the right approach for educating the public? That part wasn't so clear. Some debaters thought that simple messages would be the most effective transmitters of AMR information.
Others thought that risk information should actually be sensationalized to convince people that they should make an effort to use antibiotics as directed.
Regardless, it was recognized that the medium of information distribution must be tailored to the intended audience, since different people receive information in different ways.
Plus, the risks and benefits of proper antibiotic use to the individual will be better motivators than risks and benefits to the common good.
That's a little selfish.
Hey, whatever works.
Well, what Dr. Klein thinks will work is increasing the cost of antibiotics, at least in countries like the U.S. He cites higher copays or making it more difficult for physicians to dole out prescriptions as means of discouraging improper antibiotic use.
I don't know, though. The debaters seem pretty uncertain as to whether this tactic would actually improve compliance.
But it was recognized that a similar tactic which mandates a 3-day delay between the times of prescription writing and filling has been successful in reducing unnecessary antibiotic use.
Compliance seems to be our question of the day, whether the subject is the public, physicians, or even pharmaceutical companies. We've touched on a lot of hot topics, and we want to hear your thoughts.
Where do you stand on the ethical responsibility of drug companies in maintaining antibiotic efficacy? Do you think physicians, the gatekeepers of prescriptions, should play a bigger role in reducing resistance?
How would you fix these problems?
We'll be looking for your ideas on social media. Send your opinions our way using the Twitter handle @ISGPTweets with hashtag ISGPForum.
And if you want to read the full summary of Dr. Klein's debate, check out the full book from the Focus on Antimicrobial Resistance Conference for free on our website.
Hope you enjoyed socializing with science today. Join us next time on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.